I should tell you about this stole. Stock's mom made this stole a long time ago. Tim Kosicki, who lived across the hall from him in Washington, carried the stole here. And Rock O'Connor said, "You have to wear this stole at this Mass. And after Mass, I'm giving it to Andy." So this is a traveling stole at the moment. I want to start with three stories about Stock, and then I want to ruminate about them a bit. Story number one was when we first met almost. I was just recently ordained a priest. He was just recently in the Jesuits, about 10 years younger than me. And he asked me to be his spiritual director, and we were both pretty new at this business at the time. And I sat there, and he sat there. That story is still going on. After a while, I didn't know what you did as a spiritual director much yet. And I'm thinking to myself, am I supposed to talk? That's the first story. We've done fine in all the years since. Be patient. The second story comes from when Jerry came to Detroit to be the provost and academic vice president in the year 2000. He would later become the president, but for 4 years he was the provost. He had gotten his economics PhD from the University of Michigan about 10 years before that. And when he came, it was, you take that job at the beginning of the fiscal year, so I think he got there at the end of June and started work July 1. And I knew him better probably than anyone else in the Jesuit community at that time. And I watched him work. What he did, because the university was in serious trouble, is he worked his way through every single fiscal flow in the entire university, looking for what to make of it all as a whole. He didn't say much about it, but I noticed that by about October 1st or so, he was looking gray. Didn't say much, but somewhere in late October, he and I were sitting in the living room alone and probably drinking some scotch. And all he said was, he wasn't ready to talk about this yet, but what he said to me was, "You keep looking at the numbers and they don't get any better." Now, hindsight says, there aren't a lot of people I know in the world who could look at all those numbers and make sense of them. It was his first major contribution to the university, was wrestling with the strengths and weaknesses, the complexities and tangles of a very complex university. I think I'm going to sit down. Okay. Thank you. Because he wrestled with the whole flow of resources and expenses of the university, and he took months to do it, he began a process by which, with his boss, President Maureen Fay, they began a top-to-bottom analysis of every single budget area in the university, from the mailroom to the athletic department, to the history department, to the law school, and so on. And out of that wrestling that he did those months, they began to get a take on how much was going to be needed to turn the university around. I don't know a lot of people who could figure out what was going on. It was a great gift to us that he was willing to endure that complexity and that grim message. We're doing a lot better than that now. We are more coherent, more focused, and because the city is at a turning point, that's helping us. We are at a turning point positive. But what I was thinking of that night, I can remember sitting there. We didn't talk much about it. He just told me. It doesn't get any better the longer I look at it. That's the second story. The third story is the reason we have had this very short gospel today. I don't remember what year it was that I heard him give a homily about that saying about the treasure that's in the field. It could have been 10 years ago, maybe 15, somewhere in there. And I have an experience where I've listened to lots and lots of homilies. And some of them I say, this is undisciplined, you know, drifting. And some of them you say, it's pretty good. That's pretty good. Something here to think about. And some you say, that is really a good homily. And then there are a few, I think I could name five in my lifetime, that change your life. Something so perceptive, something so welcoming to the people who are listening makes you change yourself. And this is one of them. Here's how I remember what he said. He said, the parable of the field and the treasure, like every other parable in the Gospels, you have to pay attention to the words. It does not say, this is my remembering stock, the parable does not say that he found the treasure and went and got a backhoe and dug the treasure out of the field and cleaned it off and walked away with the treasure. He doesn't say that. It says he bought the field. Treasure is in the field. He said, whenever you find a treasure, you have to understand when you start to embrace the treasure, you're going to have to embrace the field. You don't just get the part you're thinking is terrific. You don't just get the stuff that looks like it pays off. Now, I put that homily of hers together with something that St. Ignatius teaches in the spiritual exercises. We Jesuits vow mobility. And the danger of vowing mobility, it means you travel a lot, and the danger can be that when you travel, you are always saying goodbye, and when you say goodbye, you are always sad. And so to avoid the sadness of the goodbyes, Jesuits can be tempted to not get there, to not get to the place they're traveling to, not invest in the place, not become intimate with the place, the city, the neighborhood, a profession, a friendship, a marriage. We need, he said, to buy the whole thing. That's why he came to Detroit. It is why he spent those months of his first 6 months of work there turning grayer and grayer and more worn down because he knew he hadn't figured it out enough so that he and Maureen could create a starting point. Don't you think in this room, every one of us could tell stories about how we've bought a field and then it wears on us. It taxes us. It makes demands on us. One of my closest friends, now married for 27 years, I think. I remember when she got married, she called me on the phone about 5 weeks, 7 weeks into the marriage. She said, "All right, I'm sticking with this for 5 years. I don't want to embarrass my family, but then it's curtains. It's impossible. We can't possibly do this." And you know, you'd say, well, they're still married. But you would be foolish if you didn't think of the cost of them still being married. So I think the first thing I want to say to us all in this room is we can celebrate Jerry's willingness to buy the whole field, to pay the price of investing himself in places that demand inner attention and demand courage. That is how I see him. One last thing. I have studied a fair bit of anthropology when I was doing my doctoral studies in the history of technology. And I read a lot of anthropology back 25, 30 years ago. And the theory about how you find evidence of human presence in sites, archaeological sites that are 20, 40, 75,000 years old. The evidence at the time that I started reading this stuff was tools. Tools and human remains in the same place. And the theory is humans use tools to make things that are valuable to them. It's one of the greatest human things to do. It's called technology. But about 25 years ago or so, some people began to say there is another way to ask, are there humans in this site besides tools? Because we now have some non-humans that are screwing up the tool theory because you got apes and people like that using tools, so it's not so clean to say tools say it. And the new theory, and I like it a lot, is evidence of the remains of flowers next to a gravesite in an archaeological site. So a place where people buried other people and then put flowers near where they buried those people is maybe a better evidence of humanity, that there were humans there, than tools. That when we human beings see someone who has died and find the way to say, usually with something like flowers or like singing or like weeping or like telling stories, when we do that, we are saying this is a sacred being, this person. And you can now, because you can trace vegetable remains much more accurately than we could when I was doing doctoral studies, you can pin down that that is what happened here, that this human person or these human people were buried, and with them were buried flowers. Where did Jerry go living his vow of mobility, being the Jesuit he was? Well, he went a lot of places. The reservation, the one that Creighton, and the one that I know the most and care about deeply, the University of Detroit Mercy, and then DC. Those are kind of the big places to which he went. And I think I want to say what makes him so beautiful to me is that he gave himself to each of those. He did not expect quick payoffs. It's no wonder he liked that parable. I miss him. So do you. So maybe we could imagine that our tears and our stories and our traveling to this place, this is our way of putting flowers by his grave so that they will be there thousands of years from now. Thank you for listening.